RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Wednesday morning, time for another Legal Hub on RCR. Katie Ashby-Coppins is back with me. Hi, Katie, how are you?
Good morning, Paul. Good morning, listeners. How are you today?
I will answer on behalf of the listeners, Katie. We're good, thanks, Katie. Thank you for asking.
Why? I don't know if they talk like that. What squeaky voice you have.
Well, yeah, I don't know why I put on that voice.
No, it's great.
Anyway, great to have you back. Last week's Legal Hub, well, the last Legal Hub we did, it wasn't last week, it was the week before. We had Nick Kernaghan last week with Kirsten Murford, I thought was a really interesting program, just saying, while you're here, because you were there.
Yeah, look, it was, and it was really important. It was really important to get some of those things out in the open, because I think there was, you know, blind panic, and I'm still dealing with similar issues around the blind panic of what that interim pandemic plan means. You know, the pendulum is certainly on the swing. We all need to be aware of it, but I'm just so glad that people are talking about these things. And I think Ali was on this morning and mentioned that we had had our second meeting with the Royal Commission, the commissioners, and certainly the interim pandemic plan was something that we mentioned and the fear around it. And we really just put it back to them saying, you know, there is a real lack of trust, and that's indicative in the reaction to this document. So I think that and I do hope that is heard and felt, and not treated as mis and disinformation and shut down, because that concern, I think, is genuine and needs to be heard.
Yeah, I agree. But since that chat, and I want to get caught up on MPOX, but it's ranging up.
Oh,
and timing is always of interest to me.
Yes, very interesting. So very, very interesting. And I hope you've seen David Bell's Brownstone Institute article this morning that just landed on
Monkeypox. No, I haven't caught up with it yet, but I will get to it, I'm sure.
Look, fascinating article, and just breaks it down and talks about, you know, monkeypox has been airborne before and does pass between animals and humans from time to time. Still less deaths from monkeypox than I think in 4 hours of tuberculosis. It's in the Congo. Right. Coincidentally, next door is a factory that develops, I think, the vaccines. And it's just very interesting timing. I'm not surprised that it has been released or has been defined as another fake now. That's a public health emergency of international concern. They have got stockpiled smallpox vaccines on available. It's and they're not ready to go with the bird flu vaccines yet. So, look, it's just a case of keeping everyone on edge and a bit nervous. Pop some photos down of people with awful lumps and a few other horrible conditions, and you know they can keep the fear alive.
That's why I think it's the perfect one, because of the visual nature of it. And I can see people go, oh gosh, that looks horrible. I don't want that. Great welts and poxy sores and stuff like that. It's perfect in a way. You know,
absolutely. Look, and there's much to say about it, and there's much more that will come of it. It's, I think it's also a saving grace for the Director General of the WHO, who announced it as a fake. I think it was in 2023, and then that was removed as that categorisation. So I think it's a bit of a saving face, no doubt. There'll be a lot that sits behind it in respect of the, those that fund and support the WHO, because it's beneficial to them.
And they're calling it a fake. I know it's an acronym for a, but fancy applying that, is it?
Oh, well, there's a lot of them. What was the last one? Fluke or flirt was one of the variations for COVID recently. I think someone's got a sense of humour somewhere.
Yeah, I feel that they're playing with us somehow. All right, we're not here to talk about what we've just been chatting about there. I think you want to talk about some of what Judith Collins said on this radio station exactly a week ago, last Wednesday, She was on here and we asked her some questions about deregulation of GE in New Zealand and also NIWA. That was another conversation. So presumably you've listened to that. How do you want to talk about that? What do you want to say about it? And what she said and how she sounded and kind of she wasn't, people are saying she wasn't well briefed and she didn't seem to really be across it. Where do you want to go with that?
Well, I'd really like to start off with what it means. So it was really good to hear from Ms. Collins about the fact that there would be deregulation in the to the level of GMO products would be able to be released into New Zealand environment. To date, it hasn't been able to be done. It's just been able to be done in the lab and not outside of the lab. And I think that that was really great, good to hear that clarification as to what she meant, but how it was going to happen. So deregulation per se probably is a bad description, and I had understood what she was saying, that there would be no regulation, or when I first saw some of the releases. So seeing now that there was going to be an equivalent or similar body, such as the Gene Technology Regulator in Australia, it's headed by the Office of the Gene Technology Regulator, a woman by the name of Raj Bula. It was interesting to hear that Ms. Collins considered that, you know, Australia is doing it well, all these other countries are doing it well, and, you know, there's no problems. And I felt that that dismissive attitude to there being no problems was quite an ignorant response, and one where she was clearly not being very well briefed, which you can see flow through to the NIWA discussion and Ian Wishart's discussion with you, I think, the following day. I feel that this is a minister that has far too many portfolios, as well as the Attorney General role. And I just think that she really needs to be better briefed and be much more informative. And look, the dismissive comments, or I think she mentioned conspiracy theorists twice. I think she was extremely rude and gaslit those that have been injured by the mRNA injectables from Pfizer in New Zealand. You know, it was, I think it was a pretty arrogant interview from a person that is supposed to be a person that's there for the constituents of the country in which she was voted into a party that is there to lead. I was pretty disappointed about the attitude of a minister being interviewed about very serious and real concerns, which could change the landscape and will change the landscape of New Zealand forever.
Yeah, to me it seemed like someone, one side of this argument had been in her ear, and no one else on the other side. And there are plenty of experts out there if you want to use that word. We've spoken to many of them who are incredibly well qualified in this, and had just taken, you know, the sort of the happy talk, you know, and just bought it on such a serious issue, because there's so much at stake, right? I mean, there's what happens to the environment, to nature, but also there's New Zealand's position in the world as a food producer and exporter to take into account. I did raise the mRNA with her, not to have a go at, you know, adverse reactions and all of that, but to try and make an example that you can sit there, Minister, and give us all these sort of, this, like I say, happy talk, but actually fundamentally at the most serious hurdle, the royal her, I suppose, representing they, crashed and burned on trust epically. And to many of us, that's actually irrecoverable almost.
Yes.
As it stands.
Yes.
So, but that was just brushed off. Oh, well, whatever.
Yeah. Know. And look, really incredible attitude and really incredible disrespect, I think, to real concerns that were being raised in the situation. And the reason why it's really important to have an open dialogue and be clear on these things is I've actually got a case that relates to the gene technology regulation in Australia, and that case is current. That case, I think I've talked about on the show before, and but we've gone in and out of some very incredible situations and scenarios, and they continue on a weekly basis. But that is such a really interesting situation, because here we've got, and we've written to the Office of the Gene Technology Regulator in Australia, and we've said, look, we have some concerns. These mRNA lipid nanoparticle products satisfy the definition of genetically modified organism in the Australian legislation. It's integrating into human genome. Why have you allowed these products to be dealt with in Australia without any license or approval from you, the gene technology regulator, who is the expert in genetically modified organisms? She says, well, they involve genetic engineering, but they are not a genetically modified organism. So we supplied a couple of very informative papers to the gene technology regulator and said, well, these are three papers that refer to integration of the messenger RNA into person's genomic sequence. We need to have a talk about this. This is really serious. What are you going to do? Silence. Silence. How is that appropriate? How is protecting the interests of a commercial interest, albeit they pay you a lot of money in application fees, protecting them over protecting the people that you are there to protect, not protecting them because you're more interested in the other interest? It is really incredible. So we've got the situation where trust has been so damaged. We've got regulators not doing their job on, you know, both sides of the Tasman. You write to MedSafe, you let them know about, you know, oh, there's a problem. Now we've got the situation where there's DNA contamination in these products. And you let them know. And again, they ignore you. But the EPA, which is another regulator, the Environment Protection Agency, turns around and says, oh, well, we've decided it's not a genetically modified organism, but we haven't been asked to look at this DNA contamination issue. You know, go away. So it's a situation where you've got even bigger levels of mistrust that are forming, because when you do raise genuine issues, you're dismissed instantly. And, you know, the fact that Ms. Collins came on and mentioned conspiracy and rabbit hole, I think, two or three times, you know, just showed the level of contempt at which she came to that interview. And that's a real shame. You know, she's not getting a free pass. She gets that with the mainstream media every day. And they're not doing their jobs. Someone has to. And these are really real and legitimate concerns.
You mentioned the number of portfolios that she has, like she's crammed full of them, it seems, including Attorney General.
Yes.
And that would seem to be the kicker one on the stack of them, because what sort of influence does that have over the others, let's say, that she would manage?
I don't know that it necessarily does. In her role as the Attorney General, it could be that there's some conflict there. First of all, I think, personally, where does she get the time?
Good point.
That's a huge thing. How can you be responsible for so many portfolios and also hold the role of Attorney General, and to do so appropriately and suitably, to be across everything sufficiently so you can be asked questions and not be so reliant on your public servants that operate within those departments? You know, how can you be satisfactorily across it, because you are responsible for them? You are actually duty bound to know, and she clearly didn't know so many things that were asked of her in that session last Wednesday. Also, the Attorney General has a couple of areas of official responsibility, and she has a few extra things that she's required to be across. So she's got ministerial jurisdiction over Crown Law, who are the lawyers for the Crown, the Parliamentary Counsel Office, and the Serious Fraud Office. And she's the Principal Law Officer of the Crown and is responsible for supervising the state's administration of the law and providing legal advice to the government. So it's quite interesting that she's being, you know, in her role, being asked to give legal advice to the government on these things, and yet being so dismissive of, you know, she'll be right, mate, that's okay, let's bring in this genetically modified organisms and, you know, change the way that food and humans in New Zealand will, you know, continue to evolve. It's, you could say it's a conflict of interest, but more so, you know,
okay.
There's so many, she's got to be so much across things. You know, it's reasonable that she would just be one or the other, not all of the things.
Yeah, you'd expect that someone who is the science and innovation minister, I believe she's a lawyer by trade, no disrespect to lawyers, obviously, Katie, but, you know, what does she know about science and innovation? And wouldn't you expect that someone with some knowledge or background in that, even though, you know, we're not too hot on experts, would be more appropriate, unless you wanted to sync a few things up with legal and science, I'm thinking.
Yeah, that's a bit of a tough one, because you're not necessarily always going to have someone that is a minister within a party that has got in, that has the, you know, skill set that requires her to...
Well, even an interest. I mean, I'm interested in planes, but I don't fly airliners, you know.
Yeah, look...
But I know a lot about it.
Look, I can't... yeah, you'd have to think that there is an interest and not just some personal, you know, egotistical gain in these things. You'd have to have an interest. Again, I just come back to that. How can you do so many roles and do them satisfactorily, let alone exemplary, which is what you should be aiming to do as a you know, government official of New Zealand.
Using the Australian model here, and you can talk about that. Is that a good idea?
Well, the Australian model is quite similar to what we've got with MedSafe in New Zealand, and that's a regulator of medicines. So we take that for example. MedSafe, who regulates medicines in New Zealand, receives an awful lot of its money from application fees that the medicine company looking to import that product has to pay in order to get approval. It's pretty attractive. And money does talk, that if, say, 80% of your income is coming from a organisation, a private organisation that wants to get a lot more drugs approved in the country, that they might, you know, have more approvals that they receive, that those approvals might not receive the full risk-benefit analysis that they deserve. Similarly, do we have appropriately qualified people within MedSafe to be assessing, you know, the nature of the products and these mRNA lipid nanoparticle products used for COVID-19 were actually a new class of drugs. They received a new special approval because they were a new class of drugs that hadn't been through any of the ordinary or typical trials you would go through. So you've got this conflict again of money. You've got the revolving door where MedSafe people will end up working for Pfizer if they're not working for Pfizer already. You've got that real situation. And so that's the model that I understand that they're going to be bringing into New Zealand that's going to operate for the gene technology regulator. And I do need to do that under the caveat of we haven't seen the bill yet. There's a lot more to happen. There is a couple of years of select committee. We will be very active in this area. I just call on the government just to hold back. You know, Ms. Collins did mention the Royal Commission. She did, I think, even go so far as to mention phase two of the Royal Commission. I think that that is particularly important because the Royal Commission is going to be dealing with, and this is phase two, dealing with what are the consequences of not having properly regulated those products which have now changed people's genomic makeup for the future.
Yeah, it's happened already. This is the problem.
Yes, and we can see the integration, and there's a lot of work happening around the world. You know, Professor Buchholz in California is spending a lot of time determining the integration into the cancer cell lines and the like. So there's a lot of work happening. But what's the hurry? What's the hurry? Why do you need to perpetuate the problems that Labor's already caused, unless you've just changed a suit colour jacket?
The public of New Zealand's not well informed on this. I think we can agree on that because of the mainstream media issue. One thing that we know that we've learnt, and I'm sure you know it well, is that in the scientific community, there's this hunger for patents eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they're kind of myopically focused on that. I remember being told by Gigi Foster when she was on that panel on I forget the current affairs show, but it was about a couple of months ago.
7:30.
She noticed. Yeah, she noticed on her LinkedIn that one of the panelists, fellow panelists, had looked into her LinkedIn page and only looked at what grants she'd received. Mm-hmm. So they're obsessed with grants and with establishing patents.
Mm.
And that's sort of, a lot of people are unaware of that. That's a follow the money issue right there. And, you know, it comes back to trust, I guess, again. That, you know, we've got to ask these questions and people have to be informed more widely so they know that it's not just curious scientists here. It's actually scientists or a community that is chasing money.
Mm, absolutely. And you can see that with the change of patents in the last few years. When things started becoming off patent, pharmaceutical companies do now is in order to retain the patent so that it doesn't fall off patent, so it becomes off label like ivermectin did, and anyone can then start producing it, they just adjust the chemical makeup by a few degrees and they can maintain their patent. So, you know, that's very real. Patents control monopolies make money. And that's very much what the situation is here. Just before the WHO World Health Assembly in May of this year, back on the 24th of May, there was actually a new treaty document that was, you know, signed up to on genetics and ownership of genetic material. And you know, I think you might have also already had James Rogowski on about that. And if you haven't, then I implore you to have him on about that because it's a really fascinating issue. And what they signed up to and what the effects of those is really tying into what we're seeing now.
Another thing too, because they're just trying to get the motivations of that's behind this, because it's painted as we'll be left behind if we don't do this. And Judith... or Miss Collins, listed off a whole lot of nations that were doing this and, you know, that we'd be left behind if we didn't join them. I actually got it in there. What if they're all wrong? They could be all wrong. You got to consider that. But, you know, we had Professor Jack Heineman from Canterbury University, very well qualified genetic engineer, geneticist, and he was telling us that outside the lab just doesn't mean a field of ryegrass, okay, growing somewhere, modified ryegrass. It's basically outdoor experiments where agents that can modify genetically through spray can be applied to, you know, fields. And the scalability is the issue in leveraging this technology to, you know, a business model that works. I didn't know that when I was talking to Judith Collins. I found that out the next day. But you can see it's more than just, oh, well, we need to just do something outside the lab. That has all sorts of issues attached to it if you're spraying agents that modify stuff around them and they're going to be blown everywhere. And you can talk about buffer zones and all of that. But you know how, you know, reality does its thing. That's never been described before. No one's ever talked about that.
Well, isn't that fascinating, you know? Aerial spraying of something that can modify crops genetically is what I understand you to be saying.
That's it.
And, you know, who's to say that that's and how is that going to be contained and not spread to, you know, our native flora and fauna, which we spend an awful lot of money at border control looking to protect? You know, it just sort of seems to be a pretty significant inconsistency. The other thing that we should keep in mind too is, you know, what do we know about the effects of genetically modified organisms in food and how our bodies react to those? We know that cancers are a kink in genes. You know, if we're changing and modifying things without any real long-term analysis and just going on the fact that, Ms. Collins says, the it's happened elsewhere around the world, no problems, you know, how can we have any comfort that what risks we are being exposed to have been properly exhausted? Or are you relying on the scientists that are producing the papers and the studies that are commercially supported by them to produce?
Yeah. Just to wrap up, you've had many occasions, lots of experience in submission processes, etc. And that's another thing that Ms. Collins said. Well, you know, people can have their say and it'll go through the normal processes. And there's plenty of time. 2025, end of 2025, I think she mentioned, is the target date. Mm-hmm. You know, do people listen in these submission processes? Because, you know, we've heard time and time again, 80% were against something, but it still went ahead, you know.
Yeah, so look, the Select Committee process is interesting. It's certainly changed over the last few years, and certainly lockdowns and things changed how they worked. You used to actually appear in person and give your feedback to the Select Committee if you were given an opportunity to speak, and it was 5 minutes per individual and 10 minutes per organisation. And, you know, it's much easier in a room to create gravitas and to be able to speak to the people in the room. During lockdowns, for example, we went online, and I think I had the courtesy of about two of the opportunities I had to give submission feedback on oral feedback on the submission. I think it was two times that the those that were part of the Select Committee left their videos on, and the rest of the times, which I think was another four or five times, they then started turning their videos off. So I don't even know who I was talking right to. It was just, it was atrocious. And I think really disrespectful for them to not even show their faces on the screen. So I think that that really just flies and goes to many other things, and shows, you know, the arrogance comes from the top. I think that that was clear and on show at last your last week's interview, and I think that that's flowing down to other departments. There's no genuine interest or care that serious and significant concerns are being raised.
We'll leave it there, Katie. Thanks for coming back on, and we'll stay across this. We're the only people doing it, after all. Gosh, I'm getting a bit sick of saying that, I got to say.
Well, look, it does give us a lot of material, and it's nice to actually be not repetitive.
All right, we'll talk again soon. Thanks.
Thanks very much. Thanks, Paul. Thanks, listeners. Catch you again.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.